forward. And this is one of my priority bills. That occurred to me.
Is there a problem?
Okay, I just want to get you talking.
Okay.
I want to whisper something.
All right. And, committee, I have to leave at 3:30 to go talk about education. So that I'll leave the committee in good hands of Senator Courtney as far as the rest of the agenda today. We will not be doing PERS today.
No.
And genetic privacy, we have the amendments back. We have agreement. But there was an error in the amendment. So the good news is they reached agreement. So we'll bring that.
There actually wasn't really an error, but the proponents wanted to add something to it.
Everybody together, 9:16, right? Just sure.
Yes, they're together in 9:16. I want to congratulate Senator Courtney for his intercession.
You really want to help reward me?
What?
I know what you want. I know what you want.
And then on Senate Bill 405, I hadn't heard by the bar until later this afternoon, so we'll bring that back on Monday. So, with that, welcome to Senate Judiciary. And this bill is in response to a recent Court of Appeals decision that narrowed some legislation that we passed in 1995 trying to protect the elderly, and this bill will expand what we thought we'd done before. So, Gibb, if you could give your name, please.
Yes, my name is Ryan Gibb. I'm an attorney here in Salem. The majority of my practice involves elder law. Deal with the elderly quite often. See the effects every now and then of an elderly person who has been taken advantage of in one way or another. And here in support of Senate Bill 6, which would increase or widen the protections that are available for the elderly.
Let's go on the work session.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Any questions for the proponent?
Well, now, Carrie, and go on the work session. He's lobbying me on another matter. That
move Senate Bill 6, is that right?
Yes.
To the floor of the DuPass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moved Senate Bill 6 before DuPass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Thank you. Tell Lisa for talent, and you did a good job. And I'll carry. Okay. Senator Tarnow has a guest that he'd like to introduce.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to ask if Danielle and her mother, Eva Shima Takahara, will come up to the front podium, if they would, please, along with your young lady friend from North Bay Elementary in North Bend area. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like Danielle just to give us a couple of minutes on what she's been doing at home in regards to video programs. Danielle.
I have a petition to get rid of the violent video games and some of the video game arcades in, like, public areas where kids go and play them. Because I think it influences some children in a bad way, and they get bad things off the screen that they think they can do to other people because they think it's not exactly real, because it's just a game.
How have your friends reacted to this idea?
How have they?
How have your friends reacted to this?
A lot of my friends think it's a good idea and that we should get rid of them.
How many signatures have you received so far, Danielle?
About
250. Speak up, we can't hardly hear you.
About 250.
Good. Mr. Chair, I think the objective is that Danielle has is to perhaps present legislation next session. In this regard. So that's why I asked for the courtesy of getting here a moment or so in front of the committee.
Well, thank you for your efforts. Yes, Senator Brown.
Have you asked Senator Tarnow to use one of his priority bills to introduce legislation this session?
We're both gone. I'm sorry. They're both gone.
Well, welcome to the Capitol. We hope you enjoy your day and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Have a good performance.
We will now open the public hearing on House Bill 2314. Invite Jim Marquis, Paul Cosgrove, and Sylvia Cayley to come forward. And Tim Martinez. Let me do it this way. We'll go Jim Marquis, Paul Cosgrove, Tim Martinez first, and then Sylvia Cayley second because she's in opposition. So if the gentleman could come forward, please. Where are your cohorts?
I don't know.
It's okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm honored to have Sylvia with me up here. It's fine. Jim Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. House Bill 2314 comes to you. It was introduced by the Interim Judiciary Committee at the request of the Oregon Collectors Association. It was voted out of the House Judiciary Committee unanimously. It passed the House 49-10. And welcome, Mr. Martinez. The bill repeals two sections of law in ORS Chapter 83, that is 83-830 and 83-840. There are two provisions contained within those statutes that cause creditors a certain amount of grief in Oregon. The one says, these both deal with repossessions, voluntary surrenders, and deficiency balances. But the one provision says that if at the time of a repossession or a voluntary surrender, if the amount owing on the debt is less than $1,250, the debtor is off the hook for everything. He owes nothing regardless of the value of the property, regardless of what it is sold for. The other provision, and contained within that provision, I should say that if the amount over $1,250 is over $1,250 at the time of repossession, then the goods can be sold, and the creditor has a right to go after a deficiency balance. However, in going after the deficiency balance or in attempting to collect the deficiency balance, a special statute of limitations kicks in that is very, very short. In Oregon, the standard statute of limitations on a debt is 6 years, and this says that the statute is 180 days from the date of repossession or surrender, or 75 days from the date of sale of the merchandise, whichever is shorter. For my client's collection agency, this creates a difficult dilemma because on the one hand, they want to pursue the debt and they don't want to sue unnecessarily, but they do have a fiduciary duty to their client who has assigned them the debt, and sometimes there is a very, very short time left on the statute of limitations. And so they really have to file a lawsuit sometimes when they don't want to, just to protect their client's interest in the deficiency balance that's owing, and they'd like to avoid that. It works against the debtor. I believe it works against the creditor. We talked with the American Collectors Association, asked them to help us research this. They did, and we can find no other state in the union that has a statute like this or even similar. This law has been on the books since 1973. And we just think it's time to be repealed. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
We'll take the testimony from all the witnesses before we open up for questions. Paul, if you want to pull a chair up, you're welcome to do that. Mr. Martinez.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the record. Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. I think Mr. Marquis has done a good job kind of summarizing the issues, and we just... wanted to say that the Oregon Bankers Association supports the collectors in this effort.
Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Kosko, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, and we too support the bill. I'm sorry I was a little late to second another meeting, and if Mr. Marquis mentioned this, I apologize for the repetition, but one of the issues that has occurred to us that is particularly funny about the current statute is this statute puts limits on purchase money loans and purchase money contracts. Ironically, none of these limits ever applied to non-purchase money loans and contracts. So it really is kind of a unique and unusual provision that does cause problems. As I served on the Debtor Creditor Executive Committee a number of years ago, I remember there were a number of discussions about this statute and the problem of potential malpractice it causes because it is a very special statute of limitations and limits. So we support the bill as well, and I'm, of course, happy to answer any questions.
Why don't we hear from Sylvia Cayley before we ask questions? Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sylvia Cayley, and I'm with the Oregon Law Center, and as you know, I'm opposed to this bill as it passed the House. In discussions with Mr. Marquis, and I believe I will be representing him correctly when I say this, I would prefer if this bill had never been introduced, but given that it's gotten to the point that it has, the part that troubles me most and our clients most is the repeal of the deficiency judgment protection. And as I understand it, the part of this bill that serves the purposes of Mr. Marquis and his clients the best is the repeal of the statute of limitations. And I must say that we are in favor of not having unnecessary lawsuits filed in order to protect the statute of limitations, and I do intellectually understand that this particular statute may have caused problems. In the House, while this was being debated in the House Civil Judiciary Committee, there were amendments introduced, -1 amendments, which are on page 3 and following of my testimony, and this amendment would serve my purposes very well. It would retain the deficiency judgment protection, the $1,250. It would cure the statute of limitation problem. And the reason that we're most concerned about the deficiency judgment protection is that the item most often in jeopardy here is family car. It is the only means of transportation. It is the most valuable asset that our clients have most of the time. It is necessary for transportation to work and to medical appointments. Often our clients are in a position of not having the best buying power. They often have very poor credit histories. They can't go to the kinds of place that you and I can go to purchase vehicles, for instance. They often pay more for them because of their bad credit situation. And sometimes, you know, they buy lemons. Now, I know that there is legislation going through that would set up mediation programs just to deal with this kind of problem, and I think that's a very good idea, and I definitely support that. But this protection is a small little protection. It's a small consumer protection as we are trying to have people who have been long-term AFDC and TANF recipients become more self-sufficient and get into the workplace. And it definitely will help people who fall behind in their payments, get their vehicle repossessed, not to have the added burden of having to pay this minimal deficiency judgment. And I would really appreciate your consideration of these -1 amendments as a good compromise to our problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you for your public testimony.
Mr. Chair,
does
Mr. Marquis have a response to the dental amendment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we discussed this amendment in the House, and Sylvia presented basically the same type of testimony in the House. I'm having a bit of a difficult time with this because my clients don't have as big a problem with the $1,250 as they do with the statute of limitations. Clearly, that is the bigger problem. And I always try to work with people in this process and accommodate their concerns. Clearly, the statute of limitations would be more important to us. We testified to that in the House. If the bill were, I'm not going to oppose the bill if this amendment gets adopted, certainly. Would I continue to support it if the amendment got adopted? Yes, I would. Would I rather have it without the amendment? But it's not as big a thing to me as it probably is to my two colleagues to the right.
Why don't we have your two colleagues to the right respond to Senator Brown's question then?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown,
The reason we have a problem is that it's a relatively arbitrary limit. It says that, and in fact it can be triggered by a voluntary turn-in of collateral, not just an involuntary repossession, and it allows just a write-off of a particular balance on relatively small loans, and my clients make smaller loans than some of the other financial institutions. It's a higher percentage of our balances are in this category and can be affected, so it is a higher financial problem for us than it may be for other financial institutions. There's no great rationale why on a purchase money transaction you ought to be able to write off certain things that you don't on a non-purchase money transaction. It has no great logic to us. Obviously, if people are in the kind of situation that was discussed in Sylvia's testimony, there are other options, and there are options that are often used, including bankruptcy, if this is not likely to be the only debt that would be a problem if somebody is having that kind of concern. Generally speaking, car payments are things that are kept up, and other kinds of payments are not, if you're really having stress and trouble, because the car is necessary. So I think that there are other alternatives for people in that position, and we would prefer to not have that deleted from the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I'll just echo what Paul said and add that we have the United Financial Lobby, which consists of folks at this table, proponents at this table, as well as the credit unions and the savings and loans, and they all are supportive of the bill as it came out of the House.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2314. The chair would move House Bill 2314 to the floor due pass. In the discussion, this has been a strange bill. I have had clients tripped up by the wording of it as it dealt with the statute of limitations before. And concerning the deficiency, we don't do this in our other statutes in this regard. And someone else pays for that. If there is a deficiency, it could be collected and should be collected by their own higher interest rates or different credit rating. And if someone is insolvent or is on public assistance or generally, you can't collect those funds anyway. So the chair is in support of the bill as it came to us from the House. Other discussion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, the motion carries. Chair will carry the bill. Senator Courtney, if you would make the motion, please, for Senate Bill 916.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 916.
Thank you. Senator Courtney has moved to suspend the rules as it relates to Senate Bill 916. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the word. The rules are suspended. 916 is now before us in work session. Senator Cuso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do appreciate you revisiting this particular issue, and I have submitted to the committee Act 7 amendment, which I think probably process maybe a little bit of what both of the 4 and 6 want to do. It's different than the Dash 4 and the Dash 6, but I believe will satisfy the association that's coming forward. It will help them, it will also actually help to make available more affordable housing for poor people, which is
thank you.
We have to go this extra step because we got rid of it. We suspended the rules to reconsider the vote. Then we have to do that now to get
right. You're right.
So that's fine. I'm going to turn it up.
Senator,
I move we reconsider the vote by which we
pass
out Senate Bill 916 as amended before the Budget Commission.
You've heard the motion. Discussion? Objection? Senator Q-Tub then moves the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 916.
Chairman?
Yes.
Don't we have to withdraw the Dash 6?
No, these will replace it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I actually have just a question, and I just, more for it being on the record than anything,
Could someone explain what is sharing some common space? Does that include a hallway? What does that include?
Who would like to do this? Sean.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, to explain, the big problem with the issue before was the locked door scenario to the basement that had the separate entrance, where there might not be any common shared space. Under this proposal, that would not be covered under the exemption. However, if there is any common shared living space or space within the house of the resident, that they might have to go through a door, let's say to use a laundry room, for example. I ran that scenario by the opponents of the bill originally. At that particular instance, you would have contact from the owner of the property and the tenant
on a regular basis.
On a regular basis. And this accomplishes that and enables us to be able to discriminate off familiar status and sex.
Yeah.
And I assume that the other folks that have been working on this bill are okay with this language?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I can't speak for them. I ran it by Metro Multifamily. They said yes. Multifamily, yes. The Oregon Law Center, yes. And the only, I think, people, the Fair Housing Council, and I think that David Niebel might want to comment. I can't speak for them. But
is David Niebel here?
Yeah.
Oh.
Mr. Chair, I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center. I have faxed these amendments to the Fair Housing Council at 3 o'clock when I got them. I expect that these amendments will be accessible to them. I have not confirmed that with them directly. These amendments are okay with me and the Oregon Law Center.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would also like to clarify, and I think the single-family residence language takes care of it, but I would just like to get on the record because there are situations that are similar to what I'm about to describe where I don't feel discrimination would be appropriate, and that is if you have, say, a duplex or a fourplex or an owner occupied one of these buildings, and the laundry room is part of the building, but all the tenants have access to the laundry room, and yet it's not a part of anyone's dwelling unit. In other words, they can all lock themselves off from the laundry room. Would that sort of scenario be covered under here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, no. And the reason you're concerned, what we have done is we've actually added in on line 6, all occupants, some common space within the residence. And I think when we added, initially on dash 6 and the dash 4, we were referring to dwelling units. We had legislative council specifically say single family residency to clear that particular issue up.
Okay, thank you. Other
questions? Did you have a...
I'm Emily Cedar with the Multifamily Housing Council, and I just wanted to point out, too, that it says within the single-family residence, so you don't take a duplex and convert it backwards. And this means any shared space that somebody has to, everybody has to access through. I've taught over 6,000 classes on fair housing, and if you give a landlord an inch, they'll take the mile because they want to discriminate in some cases. This really narrows it down to totally within that shared space when they're only renting out a room, not the upstairs apartments, the downstairs apartments, or the accessory unit on the back.
Okay, thank you. So if the granny flat had its own laundry facility in the little stack washer dryer or whatever, then it would not be able to be covered under this.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Objection to the motion on this is to adopt the dash 7. Hearing none. Ordered. And it's Utah.
I move for Senate Bill 916 as amended with two pass recommendations.
Thank you. Senator Cusub moves Senate Bill 916 as amended to the floor to pass. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Courtney did a fabulous job.
Yes. I appreciate that. And I apologize to Senator Cusub.
We all did.
thank you again, Peter. And the motion carries. Senator Cusub, would you like to hear the bill? Thank you. That's good.
Open the
Mr. Chairman.
First section on 461. And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 461, we had a very, very brief hearing and really very, I think even briefer work session, at which time I let you know that the proponents and the opponents of the bill was originally drafted before working on some amendments to it. I just received those this morning. I haven't had an opportunity to talk with everybody in the work group with regard to that compromise, and I know just from looking around the room that several of those members are here, and perhaps they can come before you and advise you as to whether or not the amendments actually serve their purposes.
So, one of the 461 compromisers, or whatever, you may be.
Okay. Chair Courtney, members of the committee, I'm Larry George, Executive Director of Oregon in Action. I also just received the amendments a few hours ago. The working group, I was not included in the working group. Dave Honeycutt, our Director of Legal Affairs, is at the hospital today with his wife. They had an ultrasound on their third child, so he said that took priority over this bill. So I said I would come in. I can describe the rightness often if you'd like. I've read the amendments. It's a different approach than what the original Senate Bill 461 did. We thought the original bill worked, but in looking at these amendments, we're completely agreeable. This is also a process that works for us. I think it works better for local jurisdictions. If you'd like, I can describe the rightness doctrine, but very briefly what the situation is that our people are looking for their day in court. And because of this standard that courts put on the burden on the landowner, it was very, very difficult for landowners to actually access the courts. The way we originally had the bill drafted is that a landowner could bring in an expert, and that worked for us, and say that there would be no reason to continue to make new applications to try to prove that your case was ripe or ready for court. When it came out of land use, water and land use, there were some people that said they had problems with it, weren't able to exactly figure out how to fix those problems. This working group changed that process so the burden is on local jurisdictions. The landowner makes the application. If they're denied, they make one application for all the other uses allowed in the zone. This bill would allow them, the local jurisdiction, to give them thumbs up or thumbs down rather than going to an expert. That's agreeable to us, so we're happy with the compromise.
Okay. You
sure.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Philip Powell from the League of Oregon Cities. I believe Mr. George has accurately described the process we went through. We think this is a much better bill than was the original bill, and we think that it will work for all of us and address a critical problem.
Thank you, Vice Chair Courtney and members of the committee. My name is Charlie Swindell. On behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, like the other members here at the table, I just looked at this bill today. There are a couple quick points I'd like to point out. Line 16 of page 1 is talking about the 120-day rule, I believe. It says the applicable provisions of RS 215-428, which I, if memory serves, is what we call the 120-day rule in land use. If your application has not been acted on by the local government within 120 days, you can go to circuit court for a writ of mandamus to compel the local government to issue the approval. And what we talked about in the working group was changing that to 240 days because of this extraordinary application process that they've worked out in the bill, which to backtrack briefly, I agree, is a much better approach into the bill. During the working group, I suggested that it would be better not to put a time limit of this sort in the bill. And I realize that that sounds a little suspicious if you're going to say that the local government can sit back and not be subject to a time limit under which they have to process the applicant's land use application. However, any time that a land use applicant goes in for a plan amendment, an amendment to the comprehensive plan, there's no time limit that applies. And local governments don't sit on their hands and fail to act on those. There are 1 to 2 dozen every month that are acted on in the state of Oregon. And I would recommend against having a 240-day or any time limit. Rather, just leave it like an ordinary comprehensive plan amendment without a specified time limit. And the reason that I recommend that is if you're talking about a situation where the applicant is going to come forward seeking any or all of the uses that are possible under the underlying zone, and for any possible, there could be any number of reasons, not necessarily malfeasance on the part of the local government, but for any possibility that the local government doesn't act within that 240 days, the applicant is going to be able to go to circuit court for writ of mandamus, not to order the county or the city to act on the application, but to order the city or county to approve the application. That's the very important, very powerful hammer of the 120-day rule in the land use laws, and I don't think it's really a good thing to leave in the context of this extraordinary and kind of novel type of special application that they designed for this ripeness bill. Concluding those comments, then on line 24, it's talking about how the local government has to adopt findings with regard to the application, and it says, a use for which approval is sought. I think that's supposed to read any or all uses for which approval is sought. Again, I've just read this bill once, but I think that is a change in the language that might be appropriate. Third comment, Section 5 on page 2 of the bill is some sort of purpose statement, and I'd like to encourage the committee to strike that, not that I disagree philosophically with a purpose statement or anything like that, but you have a purpose statement in legislation in order to guide courts in construing the terms of the statute if there's any ambiguity. I don't think that's applicable in the case of this bill. I mean, it sets up a process for local governments to administer and process permits, and I don't think that there's anything to guide the courts here about their application of the constitutional rightness doctrine, and I think Section 5 is surplusage. I don't think it does harm, or I don't think it does good. I just think it's kind of clutter and maybe not something that's necessary for the committee to include if it were to adopt this bill. My final comment is that Senator Bryant pointed out in our working group, and again, David Honeycutt and not Larry Gross was there at the time, and he mentioned that the remaining clause of the bill may be a problem. And I can't remember what I talked about with David Honeycutt. Actually, I think I talked with Art Slack of the Associated Oregon Counties. And Senate Bill 461's relating clause is relating to dismissal of claims alleging takings violations under the Constitution, to paraphrase. And this bill doesn't deal with the courts or LUBA dismissing a claim anymore. This bill deals with a local government process for an application. I'm not sure, but I wonder if there may be that relating clause issue that Senator Bryant brought up, and that may have escaped the notice of some of the people who are working on these amendments. And those people, I think, were Dave Honeycutt and Art Slack, is that right?
Yeah.
And Phil Fell. Those are my comments about Senate Bill 461.
Sure.
Sure.
Curry, doesn't the case can be taken into circuit court, right? It can go from local land use planning decision into circuit court, and then from there on into LUBA if necessary, but it can be taken into circuit court.
A frustrated applicant can go to circuit court for a damage action, or they can go to the Land Use Board of Appeals for overturning or getting an unconstitutional taking ruling. Two different venues for two different remedies, yes.
I'm a little bit confused, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure whether this dismissal of claims comes into play, then, if it isn't in LUBA or circuit court or what have you.
Right. Dismissal of claims, Vice Chair Courtney and Senator Turnell, it seems to me dismissal of claims would have to do with the statute dealing with LUBA's review or the circuit court's review of these lawsuits that get filed after this application is done with. Now the bill doesn't deal with review of claims after the applications are done with. The bill deals with the applications and the processing at the local level. And I'm concerned that you all may need to hijack a relating clause to paraphrase Senator Bryant to hijack a relating clause from a different bill. It's just, again, something that came to mind when I was reading the bill this afternoon.
Okay.
Further questions? Comments? Thank you very much.
But I would, for the record, Mr. Chair, point out that if Wedgwood Council has a concern about the relating clause, it's not something that they expressed
Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, we discussed that at the meeting at which we drew up these amendments, and Dave was to ask counsel when he took them in if there was going to be any problem.
And I can't speak specifically on this bill, but typically what happens is when the amendments do come back to us, they're accompanied by a memo that advises the committee as to the appropriateness of the relating clause, and we receive a message memo in that regard.
Yeah, we think it's probably okay.
Okay. Thank you. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 461.
Right
now. 7-5-0. Let me get my notes here, folks. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 7-5-0. Would Senator Leori please come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're ready, sir, if you are.
No, yes, sir. Go ahead.
Chet Ferrioli, State Senator from Senate District 28. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 750 is designed to help appellants who appeal decisions that are made in contested case proceedings by changing the review of state agency orders. It also allows the appellant, if they in fact prevail, to recover their costs from the agency if they are the prevailing party, plus reasonable fees. Let me explain. If under a state agency order a decision is made and then appealed by permittee or someone subject to a state agency order, and the order is essentially on the lower administrative review is found against the appellant, they will sometimes appeal to the Court of Appeals. And in that case, what this Senate Bill 750 would do would be to take the sideboards off of the Court of Appeals so that it can look at all the issues that were brought before the original deciding body that were made part of the record of the case. So it takes the sideboards off of the issues that can be brought into the consideration of the appeals court. Again, it has to be those items that were part of the public record, part of the court record, but it gives a little bit more latitude to the appellant court to review all the relevant facts in the dispute. In those contested cases that are subsequently found in favor of the appellant, where it's clearly determined that the state agency erred in making its decision, this bill would allow the appellant to obtain and recover reasonable fees and other expenses as the prevailing party. And it also takes the position that those reasonable fees and other expenses paid to the prevailing party would come from the state agency budget. So this actually is a situation where an appellant who may be fighting what they feel is an unjust or unreasonable state agency decision, goes through the appeal process, ultimately prevails in the appeals process at their own expense. They should be reimbursed for those expenses and the reasonable costs of bringing the appeal. So it's a situation that we think brings equity into the system where people appeal state agency decisions and heretofore have not been able to ask the Court of Appeals to look at the whole record and haven't been able to recover the costs of pursuing the appeal if they did prevail. So this is an attempt to bring equity and reason and a little bit more of the factual record into the case for determinations on appeal.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
She is my technical advisor, Senator.
Questions, Senator?
I just have a question.
Sure.
Can we hear some testimony yesterday or sometime along the line of some of these administrative procedures like Department of Corrections, the parole, they might listen to 10,000 a year, something like that. How would that affect us? Would this bill affect those things? And we could
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, it could. If those, this doesn't affect the lower order of appeals, the administrative reviews, but if they go, in fact, and are pursued all the way to the level of the appeals court, the Court of Appeals would be the court of review. And in that case, a couple things are different. The sideboards on the evidence would be dropped so that all of the records could be looked at. And that brings in some issues that may not have been available to the original appeal administrative review person. So it makes a little bit more of the public record available. It could be any decision made by any state agency. But not all of them obviously get to the point where they are actually appealed all the way to the Court of Appeals. They're usually adjudicated at a much lower level.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else?
No.
Okay. Close the public hearing. Is that Bill Senator?
That's it. Senate Bill, work session on Senate Bill 804.
Mr. Chairman, members, you heard this bill on Tuesday, and at that time, Phil Schrader and Marcia Tagle from the Water Resources Department appeared with Laura Schroeder, an attorney from Portland, and they talked to you about a compromise amendment that they are working on, and that sits before you as a -2 amendment. And I know all the parties are here today if in fact you wish to hear from them. I can tell you that the amendments specify that the bill, they replace the original bill. And we're talking in the amendments about only final orders. They removed any language prohibiting an AG or DAG from advising agencies, or advising the hearings officer. Of the agency that they also represent or had advised, and they've taken out any language that would require the mailing of the orders notice by certified or registered mail. And as I said, they are here before you if you wish to hear from them again.
Do we need to hear from them, or are we ready to adopt these -2 amendments?
They're all nodding in agreement.
Well, Chair, Senator Tarno?
We need to hear from them, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I'm sorry. Please step forward.
That's
a related.
That's all. Chair Courtney, members of the committee, what you have before you is the -2 amendments were the work of compromise we've worked out that I think deal with virtually all the issues that we had of concern before. There is kind of a technical thing in the LC drafting process. It changed the language of the proposal that we had submitted for legislative council to draft for the committee's consideration. And we think that it would be better to change it back slightly to the proposal that we submitted to the legislative council.
Okay.
It is on lines 11 through 14 of the proposed amendments.
-2s?
Of the -2s. And I have it in handwritten form that I could certainly give to you, and then I could also read it to you.
I have it in handwritten form. Maybe you could just read it for the committee, but then you could just specify what the difference is between.
Yes, okay. Okay, I would like to do that.
Beginning with the bold language on line...
Is this on page 1?
Yes, page 1 of the proposed amendment, dash 2. At line 11, beginning with the bolded language. Strike if and insert in its place a final order other than a contested case issued by, and then pick up with the language in the bolded language, the Water Resources Commission or the Water Resources Department. Okay. And
this long paragraph, that could be kind of confusing. Why don't you just talk about what the difference is and what you're trying to accomplish with your language? Because I've got it before me, and we can make the technical changes.
Okay, great. I will do it that way. That's fine. The basic gist here is to go back to simply a more affirmative statement. When Legislative Council drafted it, it was drafted in language that says, if the Water Resources Commission or the Water Resources Department wishes to issue a final order, and we think it would just be clearer and cleaner if it stated, a final order issued by the Water Resources Commission or the Department shall state on the first page of the order that it is a final order, simply to make it a more just affirmative statement, and rather than having to simply, if the Commission wishes to do something, they shall do that. And that's really the only change that we would suggest.
I'm wondering if Mr. Hendricks, who drafted the amendment, has some concern as to whether or not that language would require a final order to be issued in, other than a contested case. I'm wondering if that's the route that he went, but I'm not going to obviously second guess what he was thinking. I'll discuss that with him. So we can certainly take another look at it and bring it back if that's the committee's
support. Okay. I think the Attorney Counsel said that she wants to do it. I'll see you again one more time, right?
Rather than change it conceptually, just
okay.
I'm not comfortable doing that. Not knowing why Mr. Hendricks changed the language like that, I'm not comfortable just advising the committee to go ahead and...
Martha, would you bounce these things off of, I think it's the sponsor, Senator Adams? The proponents of the bill, would you make them aware of the changes being proposed?
And they are.
Chair Senator Turner, we have someone here who represents the Schroeder Law Offices. Ms. Schroeder was here the other day.
Okay. I didn't know who was in there.
My name is Justin Garrison. I'm here on behalf of Schroeder Law Offices. The changes that Phil has suggested near the agreement that we came to 2 days ago, almost verbatim. So, and I have a copy, actually, of the form as agreed to right here, if you would like to see now why Mr. Hendricks changed the language. I'm uncertain.
Okay.
What was the topic? The work session on
804.
Thank you.
You can open the work session.
Maybe if we have a moment here, would this be a good time for me to ask for to suspend the rules to be recorded as a yes vote on Senate Bill 6?
Very active. We suspend the rules to allow her to vote on Senate Bill 6. Any objection? And Senator Roberta votes yes. Is that correct on Senate Bill 6? That's not. Okay.
Aaron
has
the next bill, Senate Bill
789. All right. We've opened a location from 789. Are we... Aaron, that'd be great.
789. Who's it?
Wait, oh, just trying to set up? Oh, I thought I was supposed to do this. Oh, he did. Oh, so I had a set up idea. I got to set the answer.
Well, this is
what the
party
is. Yeah, I don't know what I want to do.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as committee will remember,
Senate Bill 789 deals with the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act. We previously had an introduction on this bill, and at that point, both the bar and the court were interested in having an opportunity to work on some amendments. Really today, Mr. Chairman, I believe, rather than doing a work session, this is probably more of a progress report, because the parties have prepared two amendments which are before the committee, but as we speak, the parties are working together, and I think resolving a lot of the differences between the two amendments, and if it would be acceptable to the committee, I would simply advise that perhaps more time be given to the parties to finish their work. Both Brad Swank from the courts and Gordon Dick from the bar are here, and I think we'd be able to give the court some context as to where they're going, if the chair would desire that. I also have prepared a measure summary, which in bullet point describes both of the amendments. It's a fairly complex act, and the amendments are primarily technical and procedural in nature. And so I just ask the chair for guidance on how to proceed from here.
Well, if you want to hear from expert witnesses.
Probably the only person who cares about this issue, Mr. Chair, is me.
Well, this is no big
deal.
We care, but not the extent of one solid hour, if that's what it'll be.
I've got a couple of questions for Mr. Swank.
Yeah, I was kind of saying we got to come back and learn to preserve our energy.
You want to go eat a big fat hamburger. What you want to do. Brad, I guess my concerns are, and I assume you've had an opportunity to talk with Martha Walters, and she's on the... She is on the Uniform Commission, is that correct?
Chair Courtney, Senator Brown, for the record, first of all, my name is Brad Swank. I'm the State Court Administrator's Office. Yes, I have had a chance. Martha Walters, who was on the commission, my understanding, got out of trial today at noon, and we talked for about 15 minutes. After she got out of trial, she said that she had looked at, she'd been sent a copy of the letter that I know you have, addressing my the concerns that we have. She said most of them look like technical issues that we could probably resolve in terms of some of the big issues, you know, like service by the courts, which was one for us. She said she didn't think it was originally intended that courts would have to serve those documents when it came to Oregon. But she was just out of trial and a little shell-shocked, as you may imagine. And she said she would like tonight to look over them and get in touch with me tomorrow if she had any problems. And I've been talking with Mr. Dick in the hall, and we've been going through the other technical amendments that I have in here. There are some substantive, and we haven't gotten all the way through them, but that's where we are.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, if I may, I have also spoken to Ms. Walters and sent her a copy of the bill and other documents related to the amendments and such. I've also spoken with Robin Pope from the adoption section of the bar and asked her to be included in discussions. And in speaking with Senator Bryant, he did advise that perhaps we could bring it back next week after folks have chimed in. I think real good substantive work is going on. I see Chairman Mr. Dick has raised a hand.
As it relates to prior concerns when I was before the committee related to the adoption matters, I have had the opportunity to talk with Robin Pope, and I have specifically addressed the issues about the standardization of uniform laws for adoption, that there is a uniform law that could be adopted, and the adoption bar section is not seeking that. It was a technical amendment for Senate Bill 789 to make sure that adoption is still included under the UCCJEA. And Robin Pope, when I spoke to her, which would have been last Wednesday, said absolutely the UCCJEA must address adoption. And so I do have that confirmed with her now. And that was in the only concern with Robin Pope.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think that's fine. Given that this is not politically controversial, it probably makes sense to hang on to the bill until we get the technical stuff worked out and send it out again next week. If folks are okay with that. Well, it certainly helps custodial parents whose children have been abducted, basically, by the other parent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you both.
Those were
time,
I believe that's it in terms of the committee today.
We're done?
I believe that's it.
All right.